So you want to know the Aerocast, I'll tell you the tale. We bust all the chops over Glen and Dale. We outshine Lothlorien when we bring the ill. By fire, sun, and moon, we're pacing Tom Bombadil. The freshest, the greatest, and certainly the best. We're not Cool Ranch Doritos, we bring the fucking zest. Before you sling shit saying we've run our course, realize we're repping the ultimate Arrow the Horse. And I'm your MC, leave you struck down to the letter. It's the Mesozoic era, and my dinosaurs are better. Joined once more by the dialogue tree Chris, dropping truth more brutal than Dark Metamorphosis. Best Alien Bros together with Starspawn Steed, and Oats and Apple Medley makes the best feed. Do we pull with the status quo? Earthlings take note. We're uncompromising with the effects and the don't. Open all our presents, there's never randomizers. It's all cool and interesting, like an Icarus wing geyser. So don't dare step, challenge or test your luck. Our flow stops like a phantom ice cream truck. Our ill eclipses your feeble, clumsy hodgepodge. Strap on your rocket skates and get the fuck out of Dodge. Oh, you're begging for mercy? What a joke, what a laugh. We're ice cold, motherfucker. Hearts frozen like Olaf. Yeah, Aerocast, straight the fuck up.
Oh, yeah. Matt, that was seriously amazing, though. I'm really impressed. Man. Like, that was really good.
That was hard to read. Anyhow, I'm impressed I didn't flub that much of it.
I burst out laughing in the middle of it, but it was really good.
That's probably the Dark Metamorphosis.
Yeah.
The entire intro was when I was thinking about dogs talking about Dark Metamorphosis. I was like, I got to take this dream I had about dogs talking about Dark Metamorphosis and make it into some kind of intro for the podcast. But that podcast is the Aerocast for April 2016. I am your host, Matt. Of course, I'm joined by Chris. Let's get right into our month of April. How was your April?
April's been pretty busy, first of all, now that we're right into spring. Allergies are just nonstop. I'm allergic to spring trees with the pollen, and then when it rains, people are like, oh, it's great. It's, you know, the pollen's going down. No, I'm also allergic to the moss when it's done raining. So spring is just the season of suffering, as usual.
Wow. Yeah. So it's warming up where you're at?
Yeah, it's warmer now, but lately it's been cold. It's been very up and down, but we're going to get summer eventually, and hopefully summer won't be too boiling. We've had this discussion before, but hey.
You know, you have to believe in your spirit animal, Olaf. Some things are worth melting for, you know? Can't complain that much about the heat.
So, yeah, that was really, we'll never get away from it, will we? One of the things I did this April was I went to California. I don't want to digress too much on the podcast. It's private, so I don't want to say too much on the podcast regarding my trip, but I'll say it was fun. I had a good time there. Went to the boardwalk. It was nice. Got to play Smash 4, even though I said I would never play Smash again, but I got to play as Bayonetta, and I'll say this for the podcast, Bayonetta is perfect.
Great.
I don't know how to combo with her in Smash, but, you know, since I don't play Smash really anymore, I'll never really know. But she was fun, so I think Smash did her justice.
Do you ever watch The Wizard?
Yeah, I did. You mean California?
Yeah, I didn't know if that joke would register or not. Yeah, as long as it sounds like a good trip.
Yeah, The Wizard, you know, also the greatest marketing for the Power Glove, because for some reason I did have one. I don't know where it is now.
You did.
We can have a Power Glove cast. We'll just play Rat Racer with it.
No. It'll run only. Anyhow, you don't want to get me on that digression.
Yeah, let's not.
What else have you been up to in April?
Yeah, it's been some time since we last recorded the cast, so I've been playing a lot of games since then. First of all, I finally did it, Matt. I finally beat Crypt of the Necrodancer. Danced her way all the way to the bottom.
Right on. Yeah, that's a good one to beat. And you've beat it a couple times since.
Yeah, I didn't expect the final boss. If I had done the zones individually, I thought that was kind of a special all zones thing.
Yeah.
But it was there, and it took me a few tries, but I finally made it through, and now I'm like an expert with Candence. I could probably do all zones, except I haven't been able to do that yet.
Yeah, well, the thing with all zones is you get a lot of tempo from it, so it's like, if you're doing it just on the pick your zone mode, you can always get stuff before you go in. You can spend diamonds, but yeah, I think you get a lot better equipment if you start from the beginning. It's actually easier to do all zones mode sometimes, I think.
Yeah, my biggest problem with all zones mode is that after doing, like, zone 4, after being so accustomed to that, the really slow tempo of zone 1 and 2 is just so irritating. You want to go faster, but you can't, and that impatience is my worst enemy now.
I find the worst zone for the challenge characters is zone 3, because everything's open in it, and all of a sudden everything's just on top of you. It's bad, but that's the charm of zone 3.
Yeah, so I've also completed with the Bard, who has no restrictions on the beat, so I clear that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So nothing special to talk about there. There was a final boss. That was kind of surprising. I thought there'd be at least something, even though, for story reasons, I knew the normal final boss would show up.
Yeah, it's only the three story girls that have final bosses.
Oh, okay.
And I haven't reached areas, but there's a silhouette in the boss loadout that I've never seen before, so I know that there's another boss. And, you know.
Yeah, I started working on the second special girl, if you want to call her that, for vague plot reasons. Yeah. Did I clear that one? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I cleared that one. That one was also fairly simple, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it's the third story girl that's difficult.
Right, the third story girl who you have to do it on beat or you die, and you pretty much can only get hit once because you only have one potion backing you up. You can get a second potion, but
and you can only have a dagger.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't actually put much time into her. I think I will try that one on the pick your zones mode one, because I think it'll be easier just to learn the patterns. Death metal would be ridiculous with her, but
oh man, just any of the bosses I'm worried already. Like, well, the conga boss, that always screws me up. Doesn't even matter which character I'm playing as, that boss always ruins me.
Yeah, it's like the 7th or 8th beat, you can't move. It's,
yeah.
It can trip you up.
I haven't tried any other unlocked characters yet, even though I think I have, I think another one. I think I have the, is it Dove? I don't remember.
Dove is the One Piece mode one.
Yeah, I think that's the other one I have unlocked, but I haven't tried her at all yet, so
tougher than you think, but not that bad. Monk is hard.
Oh, I've also tried playing as Monk, and that is not fun.
It's just a disconnect with the player in the game. It's like, oh, there's gold. You automatically want to jump to it, but yeah.
It's kind of interesting, though, I have to strategize on where you kill enemies, so the gold doesn't block your way or anything. But yeah, it's an interesting way to play, just really frustrating. I haven't gotten past, like, zone 1, I think. No, or at least I got to zone 2, and then I died with the Monk, so
yeah,
it's an ongoing process in that game. I don't know if I'll get back to it right away, since I think I've also kind of outdanced myself for a while, taking another little break.
Yeah, I think you put a lot of time into it, so yeah, a break is well earned, I think.
So besides that, at some point in time, I, for the spur of the moment, decided to buy Sengoku Basara for myself, which is Capcom's answer to Dynasty Warriors. And I was never really huge on those kinds of games. I played Dynasty Warriors game ages ago, and I think I played one of the Gundam spinoffs, and I was never really just a fan of them, but I picked it up anyway, because I said, why the hell not? And I don't know, maybe this time around I'm more receptive to it. It is a lot of fun. It's very repetitive, but it's, you know, the kind of thing you play when you just feel like mowing down enemies for the heck of it.
Yeah, the only real experience I have with those kind of games is Ken's Rage. But they're good mindless fun, but they do get pretty repetitive.
Yeah, I've only been playing as the first default character, and I mean, he has like 6 katanas and a special move, and it's absolutely ridiculous, but I expect as much of the game, it's supposed to be absolutely ridiculous anyway. So maybe I'll get back to that. It's kind of like whenever I feel like it. It's the HD collection, so I have Sengoku Basara 1, 2, and then it was kind of like an expanded edition of 2.
Is this on triple HD collection?
Yeah, yeah. And I had to import it, and it's entirely in Japanese, which is probably my first adventure into importing games this month. Not as bad, because it's so repetitive, but it's pretty easy to pick up. If you don't know, like, there's guides online, and then, I mean, most of the items are kind of explanatory if you mess around with it, so
you probably know enough Japanese to buy, anyways.
Yeah, so speaking of importing Japanese games, I never expected I'd do this months ago, but for some reason I now have Fire Emblem Fates in Japanese. I bought Conquest, which is the edition that has the more traditional Fire Emblem gameplay. You know, you go to chapter to chapter, you can't grind. The cooler experience, alright? Shots fired. And I have to say, after, you know, Awakening, which is a game I did enjoy, it was a very flawed game, gameplay-wise, because it was just stat inflation and really bad balance, and Awakening was a mess, basically, in terms of Fire Emblem gameplay. But they really learned from their last experience, so Fire Emblem Conquest is a lot better game. I think they really did some new things with it. They improved the pair-up mechanic, which was a new thing in Awakening, where you kind of combine two characters and they kind of get stat bonuses off each other, except I didn't like that because then maybe other character that you'd pair up with one of them kind of negligible. They're just stats now. They're not really a character anymore. That still is a thing in Fire Emblem Fates, but now it's used as more strategy-wise, like there's they use it to guard, and if they're next to each other on, you know, adjacent squares, then they can attack together. So it's definitely a refined system. Well, I guess speaking of Fates, there is that questionable fan service stuff, which I get the full experience of because I had imported the game.
I see why now, yeah.
Yeah. I'll explain why I imported the game in a bit, but I'll say after experiencing the weird fan service stuff. Overall, I think it's harmless, but I can understand why they took it out of the localized version, because some of these characters are, like, 13 and younger, probably, yeah. And it's really awkward. Like, you have the option to do it. I just don't want to do it, so I'm like, all right, if I have the option to face pet them, I'm just like, no, I'll just leave now.
Yeah.
I think if the characters were at reasonable ages, maybe this would have stayed in the American release. But, I don't know, I think this is just, it's really off-putting.
Well, I think minigames for affection is fine. Groping, I don't think anyone should have ever expected Nintendo to want this for Western audiences.
Well, groping's definitely exaggerating. It's really just face-petting. I like to describe it as it's playing Pokemon Ranger on people's faces in Fire Emblem. It's basically you just draw circles on people's faces with the stylus. You don't go lower than the shoulder area. So there's that. But just the fact that your character is probably like 18 to 20 years old, and there's like girls that are 10 maybe, it's just really weird.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, yeah.
So if you just like believe there are no underage characters in the game, it's probably fine, but since there are, it's just really weird. I mean, yeah, there's other fan service too, which was taken out. Like, I think swimsuits were taken out. I'm not sure, because I haven't really been keeping up on what was taken out. I didn't want to get involved in that mess. So
cover arses and stuff up, don't they?
I don't know. Yeah, the curtains over people.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there is, like, this thing you do between chapters called My Castle. It's like a little hub area where you interact with your characters. That's where you can do the face petting stuff. But there's also stuff like buying items there. You can also there's like a hot springs thing for some reason. There's like the arenas in there. And it's not really bad, but I feel like it's really distracting to the experience. I feel like the game really could have benefited without this hub area as a part of it. I mean, some of it helps with the game because you do buy your items there and you do buy new staffs there.
There's no on-map shops, huh?
Yeah, there's no on-map shops. They're all restricted to this hub area.
Okay.
And shops would be weird in Fire Emblem Fates because they took out weapon durability and they do have a new weapon triangle. I mean, it's still, you know, swords beat axes and axes beat lances, that kind of thing, but they also have hidden weapons. They also have, what are the other... It's just there's a different other layer of the weapon triangle, and they refined that. So I think the way they redid weapons in Fire Emblem is really interesting, and it's not as big of a deal that there is no durability anymore.
The only thing about durability that would have been my concern taking it out is that in the last couple of Fire Emblems, you could take like the first killer or brave lance you find, and then modify it, like, you know, to hell, and it would be an unstoppable weapon that did cost you a shitload of money to make it, but the durability was sort of the limiting factor to it. My only concern with that is for like killer weapons and brave weapons, how are they balanced? Because why would you not use them when you get them right?
So far, I haven't gotten many killer or brave weapons yet. I think I'm halfway through the game at chapter 18. I think there's 26 chapters in the game, not including side chapters, which includes getting the second generation, but I'm going to leave that conversation for a whole different topic, because I don't know why second generation is back in Fire Emblem, but they brought it back for the most illogical reason. I'll just say, in FE4, they had second generation because there was a time skip. Awakening had second generation because it was time travel, and they just totally bullshit a reason for this game. It's really absolutely ridiculous if you want to believe in the hyperbolic time chamber exists in Fire Emblem now.
I think it's a hyperbolic waifu chamber is the real reason for it, right? But I guess it doesn't make any sense, and maybe it shouldn't be there.
Yeah, don't try to put too much thought into it, because it makes no sense if you try to put any of the factors together on how this works. It doesn't make any sense. Don't think about it, is how I feel.
Right.
The writers put zero thought into it. I don't think you should either. But I digress. Overall, the game is really a great experience. I think the gameplay is really good. And, you know, ridiculous stuff aside, with the fan service, if you can try to ignore it, or the hub area, which I find really distracting. I mean, it's not bad. It's just something that takes away from the cohesiveness of the game. There's right. kind of a dissonance when you have this hub area in between chapters, and it's just weird, in my opinion. I'm so used to having shops in each chapter, and you struggle for money and stuff like that.
You just fucking commute to the battle every morning, like...
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. No, it sounds like they've improved on a lot of things you want them to improve on, and... I mean, a lot of people, including myself, railed on the fact that there are multiple versions of it. I guess it's not such a bad thing if it allows them to make an experience for people that want a more modern or new Fire Emblem experience, and another one for people that want a more classic Fire Emblem experience. I guess that's all right. Still don't agree with multiple versions.
Actually, I think having multiple versions is still kind of obnoxious.
Oh, of course it is. Of course it is. Yeah. It's the Pokemon syndrome there, I guess.
I think the worst thing about it is that you have the both games, and they obviously have different gameplays, but they also have two different sides of the story, and then you never get the full story, because there's the third route that's DLC, which you get the whole thing, and it's just like, I don't know. It's really a mess that they divided this game, honestly.
Is the DLC literally both stories?
It's not both stories. It's like, you play out the game up to chapter 6, because you have been raised in this family, and then you find out there's your birth family on the other side of the kingdom. So in Conquest, you decide to stay with the family that's raised you, and in Birthright, you stay with the family that is your blood.
Yeah.
And the third route is like, hey guys, we have a greater enemy, let's just be friends.
I went to Ancestry and decided to betray the people that raised me. I thought I was this, but I found out I was this, so I gave up on my heritage.
Yeah, there's a lot of criticisms about the story. Like, the story was improved in localization. I get stuck with the Japanese version where I just roll my eyes.
Yeah.
When I started playing the game, I was like, oh man, I can like read Japanese now. And then I like picked up stuff, and then I hit a point eventually where I was like, the story is really bad. I don't even want to put effort into this anymore.
Well, I'm sure it's not so bad.
It's not terrible, but I was just... This isn't worth the effort. I'll just look up a summary kind of thing.
Right. The core story's probably all right. It's probably the individual characters that are irritating this.
Yeah, the character you control is really naive. It's like, how many times can you just fall for this? And I don't think the story gives you a good reason to believe that the character is so naive. Anyway, this is just me ranting about Fire Emblem now.
Oh, well, I gotta get the news.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll have more if I beat the game.
You think you will play it in English on the other path, or...?
Just because everything, like, kind of connects with itself, I'll just probably download the other path, maybe, or the third path.
Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of the, quote-unquote, discount if you buy one physical copy. You could just DLC the other two ones. I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah, it's kind of slimy, but...
It makes me a little worried about what they're going to do for Fire Emblem 15, but as for now, I mean, gameplay's good, not so great at your selling model.
Isn't Fire Emblem 15 like Tokyo Jam Sessions?
Yeah, probably. Oh, man.
You know, in a vacuum, you might be like, oh, man, that game looks fucking dope. But it's got the Fire Emblem name attached to it. Do you think that's a factor that you don't like it?
If I have to put my 2 cents in about that game, I think had it not been marketed as a Fire Emblem and Shin Megami Tensei crossover game, I think it would have been fine. But since they say, hey, it's actually a Fire Emblem game, it's also Shin Megami Tensei, please buy it. And like, this looks nothing like either series. Like, I think if they just did a new IP from the start, they just said, hey, you know, Intelligent Systems and Atlas is doing a crossover game, but it's not based on any of the IPs, they'll probably be okay. And they probably would get less vile about it. But yeah, here we are.
Isn't it literally just Fire Emblem in high school, though? I mean, isn't that, like, the anime dream? Anyways, I digress.
Anyway. So, a lot of people think I imported the game because I have some incredibly obnoxious censorship reason or something. No, the actual reason is because in Fire Emblem Awakening, my favorite character was not localized well. And I always nitpick about that, like, why did they change his backstory? It was a perfectly good backstory. Was there a reason why the English version had to remove some depth from this character? And this was just me nonstop about my favorite character in Awakening. So, as the Japanese game came out way back in June, I mean, I didn't really know most of the cast by then. I knew some of them. And I was reading up on people, so I'm like, oh, this character is really interesting to me. I really like this character. So now I'm attached to this one character from the Japanese version. And by the time the English version came out, I found out he was also not exactly localized to how I would have wanted him to be. So I just decided, instead of just ranting about it for, like, years on out, why don't I just buy the Japanese version so I don't have to complain about it all the time. And this is where I am now.
Right.
It's the most ridiculous reason, but this is also me you're talking about.
Is there memes in the English release?
Kind of. I mean, nothing like the Triforce Heroes fiasco.
My 2 cents on that is Dozier's a fucking good meme. Like, get off your high horses. But anyways, continue.
But otherwise, yeah, that's pretty much the reason why I have imported the copy. It's because I didn't want to complain about one character. Both versions have their ups and downs. The Japanese version has some really sketchy writing, which I'm sure is all over the internet, because that controversy went on for weeks on end. And the English version has its own problems, which are not about censorship. I feel like it's such a huge game that 5 localization teams worked on it, and they didn't really come together for the final copy. So it's a little inconsistent, and that's a little weird to me. Kind of rubs me the wrong way. But again, both games have their plus and minuses. So, hey, there you go.
Does the UK have a different localization?
It's not out yet, actually, so we don't know yet.
Okay.
It's actually out at...
Not that it would matter. You'd have to get a UK 3DS, but...
Yeah, so... Yeah. I don't think I'm going to be that wild enough and import a European 3DS. But yeah, that was my Fire Emblem discussion. But I can move on to more positive news. So at the end of March, a game I've been looking forward to for months, maybe years even, ever since it was first launched on Kickstarter, Hyper Light Drifter came out, and, you know, there was a part with me where I was starting to get worried, like, what if this game really isn't what I was hoping it would be? Because I remember from the trailer, it looked aesthetically like everything I liked. It seemed like the right blend of the sciency and fantasy, and it was a top-down action-adventure game, kind of like Zelda. And I was like, oh man, this looks so cool, and then I just tried to pull myself back a little before I got too excited. I couldn't help it anyway as the final days were approaching. But at this point, I am almost to the final boss, unless I'll be in for a surprise and there's a final area after I did the 4 cardinal directions. But so far, I really, really like this game. The combat is really fluid and very rewarding. I mean, there's some tough parts of it, but the game expects you to die a whole lot anyway. It's a learning experience, and it's a very huge world. Lots of secrets hidden throughout, so you have to be really thorough whenever you go through an area. It's also very cryptic. No one really talks in the game, so you have to piece together the lore yourself. A lot of people, when you talk to them, they don't even say dialogue. They actually just usually give you like a little picture scenario summarizing what they're trying to say. So it took me a really long time to even figure out what the story was, really.
Right.
But
don't spoil us.
Don't spoil, yeah. I think just the scenery is really great. The music is wonderful. Just playing the game is so fluid, and just it's really refreshing to fight all these enemies and getting new abilities. It's really fun, and I really recommend it. I just can't say much because there's a lot of spoilers involved, but yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I meant to play it this month as well, but I never, well, for other reasons, I didn't get around to it, but I'll be giving it a spin within the next month or two, I think.
Yeah, there's
do have it because I did the Kickstarter as well, but yeah.
Yeah, if I had to really boil it down to something, I guess I would call it Zelda 1, but with a really fluid combat system. It really feels like that to me, and, you know, if Zelda ever does a really cool top-down Zelda game again, they could use this for inspiration. Maybe.
Yeah.
Except, you know, Zelda now, but that's a whole other topic. But Hyperlight Drifter was great. I would really recommend it. I really love the game a lot.
Sounds good. Sounds good. So it sounds like you had a lot of games this month.
Yeah. But enough about me ranting, and also, I know I talked way more about Fire Emblem than I did about Hyper Light Drifter.
Yeah.
But what's been going on with you, Matt? I hope you've been doing a lot of productive things, watching some great shows.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. Just going into spring, spring's been all right. It's been kind of rainy, kind of cold, but it's getting warmer now, and I've been enjoying it by basically watching a lot of anime. I don't know. I must have caught a virus from you the last time we talked, but anyways.
Oh, yeah. So right for discussion about.
Before I get into that, as for games, I did a couple of crawl runs. Some were victorious, some weren't. Usual kind of thing. Talked about crawl so much on the podcast, I'll just say that I was playing crawl, as per usual. I also played through Adventures of Lolo on the Game Boy. This is the UK version of the Game Boy game. It has about 100 more levels than the Japanese version, so it's a lot longer experience. It's got a lot of like flavor in it. It has like little cute animated cutscenes between each set of puzzles. It's kind of strange for a Lolo game to do that, but it kind of works on the Game Boy. Kind of gives it a different kind of feel. A bit more jovial than Dreadus, like Famicom games are. So it's pretty good. The only real drawback to being on the Game Boy is Lolo moves a little bit slow. Most of the puzzles take that into account, but I do kind of miss how fast he moves in the NES games. So that was a pretty good game. It got quite hard towards the end, of course. You know, looking for a puzzle game on the Game Boy. It's got tons of them, but Lolo UK Game Boy game is A1.
I was going to make a little quip that, hey, remember when you didn't have to like import brand new consoles to play imported games on your Nintendo system? Nintendo!
Yeah, sure. I should mention before I leave the Lolo on Game Boy. It's Super Game Boy Enhanced, and the Super Game Boy enhancements are beautiful. And there's when you complete a set of levels, there's like this clapping sound effect, but it's only when you play it on the Super Game Boy. And I played half the game on the Game Boy player, and I was like, oh, this is a Super Game Boy Enhanced, I should play it on the Super Game Boy. It had a beautiful border and a clapping sound effect, so I was like, what the fuck was I missing here? You know, shit, I like clapping sound effects.
Must have clapping sound effects.
Which is bizarre, because the next game I'm going to talk about is another Game Boy action puzzler. It's Chalvo 55. It's sort of what became of Bound High on the Virtual Boy. Bound High was sort of a game where you're always bouncing and knocking out blocks and things like that, and it never really saw the light of day. Like, there's betas available, but it wasn't actually released. It's unfortunate because some of the Virtual Boy games, although they hurt your eyes, some of them actually look pretty good. This one looked pretty good, but it was reincarnated as Chalvo 55, and the game has terrific music. It's like 1997, but it doesn't have Super Game Boy enhancements, which is really bizarre to me.
Oh, man, I would have loved that clapping.
I would love the clapping too. But no, it's kind of bizarre for a Game Boy game to be released that late and not have Super Game Boy support. I think it's right on the precipice of when the Game Boy Color was released as well, so it's even strange that it wasn't just a move to the Game Boy Color. But the game starts quite easy and quite open, and you're just bouncing. Basically, when you jump, you turn into a ball. And it's kind of like Ball Kirby, except it's not complete horse shit.
Oh, wow.
Well, if you ever use Ball Kirby, it's with the worst fucking power. But Chelvo, he can only push things when he's a robot, and he can only bounce on things when he's a ball. So it gets really, really hard. I actually got distracted from the end of it. I still have one stage to go back and do. It gets really hard towards the end of it when you have to do precision bouncing on the Game Boy. But it's got great control. It's just, it gets really, really precise. And of course, it's one hit and you lose a life and all that. So it gets really tricky. It starts really easy and it gets really tricky. It's a really solid game as well. I can recommend it to anyone who likes action puzzlers on the Game Boy. And if you collect for the Game Boy, you probably like action puzzle games because it's like half the fucking library. But I'm all right with that because I like them. That's the games I've been playing. Now let's talk about the anime I've been binging on because
I watched proud. A lot.
Oh, I'm proud of her, yeah. Strange. I mean, I haven't watched anime this frequently since a long, long time, and not quite as frequently as some people. I tried to watch Hokuto no Ken Ichigo Agai, and that's like Fist of the North Star, Strawberry Style or something it means, and it's like sort of a anime adaptation of a manga, and like of a super deformed Hokuto manga and the actual Strawberry Flavor manga featuring Souther from the original series. Anyways, it's fucking terrible. It is really, really fucking terrible, and I don't recommend anyone watch it. And it's not just because I feel, oh, they're making fun of Fist of the North Star. It's just really scatterbrained and shit. So don't watch it. Don't watch it. Next up, I got back into Sailor Moon Crystal. I kind of gave up on it because I was like, I don't really like the art and I don't really like the animation from the first few episodes. It does improve as the seasons go on, but Season 3, I should talk about on the podcast. Season 3...
That's a new one, yeah?
That's the current one. That's the current one with the Outer Senshi start to appear in it. So the big improvement with it is that it's drawn better and it's animated way better. Like, their heads don't look squished and they don't have... Anyways, it's a lot better animated. It's sort of it sort of gets away from the manga flavor that they were trying to go for with the first two seasons. But I don't think the style that they were going for in the first two seasons worked terrifically with animation. And I just find season three less lazy and drawn better. So overall, it's good. I mean, anyone can jump in on season three if you know Sailor Moon. I think this is following the manga chapters fairly closely. So it's quite truncated from the original anime, of course. But you could jump in on season three if you're a fan of Sailor Moon and enjoy it just as much. And I mean, I'd recommend watching the first two seasons because they're not bad. But season three so far has been really good. So there's a marked difference there.
Yeah, I was actually never really a big fan of Sailor Moon. I remember watching Sailor Moon, like, the first two seasons. Not Crystal, like, in general, when whatever the story arc was. But yeah, there was Sailor Moon, there was, like, Sailor Moon R, whatever they were. And I remember watching them, I just wasn't a fan of them. They were passable, but then, you know, Sailor Moon S came out, the Outer Senshi came out, and I'm like, whoa, Sailor Moon's awesome now! So, yeah. That's why I passed on watching Crystal, because I just didn't care much about the first two seasons of Sailor Moon, but now that they're up to the story that I enjoy and the characters I enjoy, I think I gotta get onto Crystal now.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad place to jump in if that's the story that you like and the art's better, so it's a better place to start. I mean, I watched through the first two seasons because I've got nostalgia for Sailor Moon because I did watch a fair bit of it as a kid, It was one of the first TV series that billed itself as an anime. It was that in Dragon Ball, the original Dragon Ball, which I like more than Dragon Ball Z, for the record. Those were sort of some of the first shows that, for youth in Canada, were billing themselves as anime. And I think I went over this when we did the cartoons podcast, but I kind of gave up on Sailor Moon when the voices changed, the dub changed voices and drastically too. And not to say that one is better than the other, but it's like I it broke my immersion with it, so I kind of gave up on it at that point. But I've never seen beyond sort of where Crystal's at now, so I'm interested to see where it goes from there. I'm not actually privy to a lot of the information. I've heard, things about the Sailor Stars and all that shit. I've heard that kind of stuff, but I've never really looked into it, and I've never actually experienced that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting and cool to see where this goes.
Wait, so have you actually seen this story arc previously, or this is when the voices changed?
It's where the voices changed is when she became Super Sailor Moon, but I've watched a lot of it. I think I gave up when Chibiusa was making out with a Pegasus or something.
Yeah, that's the
So.
next season. I was gonna say, when Crystal gets to that season, I'm dropping it again. Because that season was terrible. I was like, oh yeah, passable, passable, great season, and then I'm like, what is this? And then Stars came out, and Stars was hilarious because it was just so different, but that's another story too.
Anyhow, season 3 is really good. Like I said, I don't know what's coming up. I only saw a bit of that horse stuff, so
That's the next season, Matt, so don't worry about it yet. Just enjoy season three for
I'll
now.
probably still watch it, but I remember I was like, what the hell happened to the voices, and why is she kissing this horse or whatever?" This is like, I guess She-Ra likes Swift Wind. I guess it's sort of, and
This is
Gandalf likes Shadowfax. So it's
really
like.
digressing.
Anyways, moving on. Did you watch the Ace Attorney anime at all?
Yeah, I'm keeping up with that. Yeah.
Yeah. How are you liking that?
I was making fun of the animation when it first started, and that opening is really funny. Because what is that scene on the beach, and then they just pull the chains, and then the, what do you call them? The scales come out, whatever. Anyway, it's ridiculous, but
Well.
it's doing a really good job at adapting the game, in my opinion. The investigations are really quick now, which I thought was really funny. But
Yeah, like seriously quick, yeah.
they didn't even have that argument about the ladder and the stepladder, which really upset me. Maybe next week we'll do it, but
I forgot that was supposed to happen now, but it's like, man. Man, you got Maya in the show now, finally, and you can show her having a weird lipstick ending to the show, but you can't have her talking about stepladders.
okay, yeah, so I'm making nitpicks here, but yeah, overall I think it is doing a really good job at adapting the game into the short amount of episodes they're gonna do. I heard they're gonna do game two as well, so I'm just like, ah!
There's a circus incoming.
Yes. But hey, if the
Imagine in
investigations are going as quick as they are right now, maybe I don't need to worry about it so much. I still hate it, but it won't be as terrible as it could be.
Imagine Matt Ungard's hair flip with all the extra poomph they put into things on this anime. It's
Oh,
like,
man.
it's going to be a fabulous hair flip. I maybe like the first episode more than I've liked the next few. I don't think it's the ideal format to experience Ace Attorney in, because like you said, it's a bit too quick. It's funny because the anime's really quick, and the game often belabors the point like way too fucking much.
Yeah.
So I mean, the games are all quite tedious at times, but I hope they at least do Trials and Tribulations, and it'd be nice if they did them all and did two games per season or whatever, but. I like where it's going now. I don't like shows that mix 3D and 2D, and it's really awful
It's really
in this
awkward in
show.
this series.
Yeah. And the characters are drawn all right. I've got a couple little nitpicks about it too, but I like Nick and I like Maya.
Yeah,
It's
it's
weird because
enjoyable. Yeah.
the sub I'm watching uses the English names.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
was like, you know what? I'm used to those names. I might as well watch the sub that names in that way. But you know, I'm going to keep up with it. I think it's easy to keep up with, and I'm familiar with the material, so yeah, it's all right. It's all right. Not a bad anime.
I do hope they animate Rise from the Ashes, because that is a really good case as well.
Oh, the Gantt case?
Yeah, yeah. Especially
I'm
since,
curious to see if they will.
I mean, I feel like, I mean, it is canon now, because, you know, that girl comes back in a later game. It's not really spoilers. Yeah. I'm not telling you who it is or what she does, but I'm just saying that's happened, yeah. So. And David, it's a really good case, so.
I've played Apollo Justice, so I know she comes back, but.
I'm talking about our listeners, Matt, okay?
As for anime movies, I know you're thinking, oh, you're skipping something, but I'll be back to that. That's just because we'll end on that note. I've been watching a bit of Haruhi again, and I kind of forgot how much I liked it, and it's kind of weird how much I like it, considering I don't really like that kind of genre, but I like Haruhi, I'll admit that. I watched the Disappearance movie for the first time, and that was actually really good. It didn't feel like 3 hours, but it was, and the mystery of it was actually kind of good, and you basically figure it out partway through it anyways, but the way that people come to the conclusion of what's going on and how we arrive there and all that, it's actually a fairly good movie. And yeah, I didn't regret watching it. So it was that was a good movie night. That was a good movie night.
So you also watch season 2 though, right?
Well, I'm watching the show with my brother, and we're on a break from it now because he's not on the island right now, but when he comes back, we'll pick it up, and we actually watched the first episode of Endless Eight before we hung it up for a while, so we might marathon that when...
Be prepared to see that seven times after that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know all the...
Yeah.
But, so I think that's the first material they're showing from season 2. I don't like the songs as much, but we'll see how it goes. I'll talk more about Haruhi on the next podcast, because I'll probably be more complete about it by then. But yeah, I like the movie.
Yeah, I'm not surprised you just went to the movie right away, because I expected you to watch the movie after season 2.
No, the only thing that they kind of reference Endless Eight in the movie, and I kind of had some of that spoiled on me anyway, so
yeah.
Like, I didn't mind. And I watched the first season, like, when it was coming out, or when it was getting subbed. I watched it ages ago, so I knew a lot of the stuff, and it was kind of interesting just to see what I remembered. And I had watched a couple of episodes before I watched the movie, so I was refreshed enough to enjoy it, I think.
Yeah, I was just asking about the movie, because I think the movie is a lot better after going through that struggle of season 2, especially since it came out after season 2, and we had to... Well, okay, like, I was also really big into Haruhi. I was out, you know, the first season I watched it, so, like, a hipster. But,
yeah.
I mean, the light novels were already out, so we all knew the summary, and we were all hoping, like, oh man, is Endless Eight really 8 episodes? Like, what are they going to do the rest of the season? Aren't they gonna supposed to cover Disappearance after Endless Eight? And they never did. So, finally hearing that it became a movie was, like, a huge sigh of relief, but it was also just the fact that they had to go through all of season 2 to get to this arc that we really wanted to see.
Yeah.
So, that was what I was trying to lead up to.
There's still, like, half the series to make, though, isn't there?
I don't recall.
Like, I know there's a lot more material, and from what I understand, Endless Eight kind of killed the series a little.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, I'm talking in a vacuum, and I'm talking before I've watched the whole thing. I don't mind that they did that. I think that's very ballsy to do it. Like, you could have made it in 3 or 4 episodes, because you could have done, like, a time-lapse kind of thing, or sped things up. So, and it's going to be interesting how I feel about it at the end, but I don't mind that they did it. I think it's interesting that they did it.
I think you'll definitely have a different experience, because you'll be binge-watching it, where I was watching it as it was coming out, so, you know, week after week, it's like, oh, it's this episode again, hey! And going through that for 2 months, it was, yeah.
I was going to watch season 2 as it was coming out, and I forget why I didn't, but, yeah, I didn't, so there you go. The other anime movie I watched, it was just a few days ago, was Tokyo Godfather's Satoshi Kon movie, and that was a good movie. It's about three vagrants that find a baby discarded in the trash, and they try to track down its original mother and all that, and sort of the baby kind of brings them together and kind of resolves their some of their issues and things like that. It's like, I don't want to get too much into the plot of it, but it's a movie that's definitely not for everybody. But I don't want to talk about characters and story in it too much, because that's the whole point of it. It's not like an action movie or anything like that. So it's worth a watch. It's worth a watch. It can be a bit vulgar at times, but yeah, it was a good movie. Good movie. It was funny. I actually, when it climaxed at the, like, when everything came to a head at the near the end, when it peaked, I was quite, I guess, feeling it at times. So I kind of burst out laughing when the tension broke. So movie got to me a little bit, I guess. And you know, it was a good movie. Good movie. I was like, someone recommended me, oh, just go watch Tokyo Godfathers. I guess it's going to be like totally a Yakuza movie or something. But yeah, it wasn't what I expected. No, it wasn't what I expected, and I'm glad it wasn't what I expected. I enjoyed it more for that, I think, without having any kind of expectations about it being Ponyo or anything like that, right? It's like, no, I'll enjoy it on its own merits. And usually movies that build themselves as comedies I don't find funny, but I found this funny at times, and I found it quite engaging at times. So yeah, it was a good movie. I guess what sort of started the whole anime binge was that, I mean, it's been a long time since we recorded the last podcast, sort of late March released the last one, and it's now early May that we're doing this one. So I've actually did watch a lot of anime, and a fair time sink was actually Hellsing Ultimate, and I kind of want to get that time back. And maybe I've been trying to fill the void by watching better anime. Hellsing Ultimate, people have told me in the past, and I won't name names because I don't want to shame you on the podcast, that, you know, if you like Fist of the North Star and movies with a lot of, like, that kind of action, oh, you like Hellsing Ultimate, and, oh, you like Castlevania, well, you probably like Hellsing. I'm like, okay, whatever, I've heard that one before. Have you heard Castlevania?
Hellsing before, yeah, that one.
I watched this one with my brother as well. I was like, oh, do you want to watch Hellsing Ultimate? You know, I heard good stuff about that, and he likes some of the studios involved. The fucking show went through three studios. That should raise some flags right there. I guess what I didn't like about Hellsing Ultimate was that it's kind of like empty calories. It's kind of like a junk food anime that has no redeeming qualities. It's like, the only redeeming quality is one character, Anderson, is the only good character in the fucking show.
Man, you really love that character.
Oh, he's funny. He's legitimately funny. And, like, just on the outset, the animation in the first episode is bad. And blurry, and mix of CG and 2D. So I'll right from the get-go, I'm kind of like, yeah, it's not that great. And it almost seemed like they're going to build an interesting story, and then it's like, oh yeah, by the way, our ancient enemies are the Nazis, and now they're all vampires. And I fucking laughed my head off at the reveal of that. And from there, the story has no ground. It's like, no plot to it. It's just, like, Hellsing is like masturbation. It's just like, or it's like an anime that wants to be a porn or a hentai or whatever, but it doesn't go that far so that it doesn't have to get like an adult rating to it. It's sort of gore porn for like little boys that think they're edgy as fuck to watch this show. I like gory stuff at times myself. I like Ricky O is one of my favorite movies to watch for that kind of stuff. I like anime with a lot of that kind of action. That's fine. But it has no traction in Hellsing Ultimate. There's no reason for it. It's just there to be gratuitous, because the story is completely empty. It's completely shit. And I've never seen an anime that can talk for, you know, the almost an hour and not tell you anything of substance. Like the major, the Nazi leader, he talks for like 15 fucking minutes about how war gives him a boner, and I'm not embellishing that. He talks about how war arouses him, and it's like, dude, you could have had fucking 3 speeches in the time that they've done this. And I was literally looking at my brother, and I was like, is this going to fucking end? And it's like, he says all this stuff, but he literally says nothing. And I know people are like, oh, well, you're not watching this story for the plot, you're watching for the action. The action's not that fucking good. The action's not that fucking good because the anime's not that well animated. There is good animation. I think it's episode 7 with Ceres. That's a really good episode, and like probably the best episode of the series. That's actually animated well. The characters are terrible. Like, why does Integra have to screech, search and destroy 20 fucking times after Alucard asks her for the 20th fucking time what her orders is, even though she's fucking said it 20 fucking times earlier in the episode? And he's like, my master, Integra, blah, 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 Wingate, Helsing the Third. And it's like, Integra could have been a good character, but the show wouldn't let her. Ceres would have been a good character if she had actual character development. She goes from being a scared youth to being a killer vampire, like that. It's like, where's the fucking character development? Alucard basically molests one of the vampires to death, and is like, fuck, what the fuck is with this scene? It just goes to show that it's like, oh, we want to be softcore porn is what we want to be. But it is a bad anime. It has some entertainment value, and it has unintentional humor because it's so Machiavellian and so over the top. But the over the top Machiavellian shit is so overblown and so tedious and goes on so fucking long without saying anything. It's like, we kind of were in it for the long run after that, and it's like, we can finish it. Maybe we shouldn't have, but I'm the kind of person that if I want to talk about something at length, and I have at this point, I have talked about it at length more than I wanted to give it, but I want to see it through to the end. I actually kind of want to see the end of Anderson's arc, and that's kind of good. Like, anything with Anderson is usually really good, and unfortunately, it also features about half hour of dialogue of saying nothing at all every fucking episode. People can say you don't get it or you don't get it. This is a fucking shallow fucking anime, shallow paper thin plot. There's not much to get. And they say you're not watching it for the right reasons. The fucking show doesn't give you the right reasons enough to watch it. It's like, it's not there. Anyways, that's just Helsing Ultimate shit, and I'm probably not going to watch the original, and I'm not going to read the manga. So, people that told me it's like Castlevania, it's not like Castlevania.
No, it's not.
No, it's not like Castlevania.
Well, I'm curious, since I actually did like Helsing in my youth. How do you feel about Integra and Walter? Because they were my favorites.
They're all right. They're all right. Walter's kind of fuck off by the end of it, and Integra got worse and worse. She wasn't bad. I didn't like when she screeched search and destroy.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm a bit biased because at that point I was like, I want these characters to shut up. But no one really compares to Anderson in that. But and it's funny, he's so over the top and like gritting his teeth and walking forward with shadows all over his face, and that made me laugh the first time. And his gun says like Jesus Christ is in heaven and all that.
Yeah.
This is fucking funny. It's fucking funny and ridiculous. And I mean, I know it's not meant to be taken seriously, but the show takes itself so fucking seriously. Like I said, I guess it's unfair for me to say that that the audience is preteen edgelords, but like, you know, you can be edgy as a preteen, guys. That's fine. Just don't do it with Helsing Ultimus. developed by Johnson Vorsinger Productions, later Toe Jam & Earl Productions, and published by Sega in 1991. Toe Jam & Earl is often considered an action roguelike game. One of the most unique titles on the Genesis and Mega Drive, Toe Jam & Earl emphasizes exploration, avoidance, and cooperation, and stars the two funkiest aliens on the console. It's a non-standard game by most accounts, and it's noted for its involving gameplay and colorful flavor. So, Toe Jam & Earl, we've mentioned this a lot, and we talked about it a bit on the Roguelike podcast. What was your introduction to Toe Jam & Earl, however?
I'm pretty sure it was you who introduced me to Toe Jam & Earl. I think you brought it up at one point, and then we did that one little co-op stream together, which was very wonky, but we made it through.
Yeah.
If previous to that, maybe I had heard it in passing just because it was a pretty popular game for the Sega Genesis. It was one of the defining games, but my proper introduction is probably through you.
Yeah, we did the, before we did the weekly stream thing for a while, we tried over internet Toe Jam & Earl stream, and we've played it a couple times together since then as well, so.
Yeah.
My introduction to Toe Jam & Earl was actually GamePro TV as a kid. It made me incredibly jealous of the Genesis that they had this game that was funky as hell, and I was like, man, these aliens got it going on, and it's a game I had wanted for a long time. Like, there's a few games on the Genesis, like Herzog's Way and Toe Jam & Earl and Echo the Dolphin, but actually should have been Echo the Tides of Time, that I wanted, and were part of the reason that I started collecting Sega later in life. So, yeah, that was my introduction to Toe Jam & Earl. I didn't play it for a long, long time afterwards. I have sort of a thing where unless the game's like $500 or something, and I just assume play it on my own console and have the original experience. So that's why I didn't play Toe Jam & Earl for a long, long time. Anyhow, that's our introductions to Toe Jam & Earl. How does the game actually play? Because it's a bit of a strange one.
Well, you can either play it solo or co-op. Assuming you're doing a single player, you just, you know, either choose either Toe Jam, who is smaller in size, but he has less health, and then you have Earl, who is larger in size, but he has more health, and he moves slower, I think, too, right?
He does, yeah.
Yeah, so Toe Jam's faster and all that. Then you start off, you gotta collect your ship pieces. You go in these hip, cool elevators going through each floor, which are randomized, by the way. You collect presents on the way, which are also randomized. Hopefully the floor has a ship part. If not, you have to look for the next elevator, basically the exit. Keep pressing forward. I don't know how many ship parts there are. I just... Assuming you go through each floor... You go through each floor one by one anyway, so you'll get them. Yeah, that's basically it. You go through all 25 floors. Hopefully the ship part is there. If not, you just keep progressing upwards. Sometimes you can go down for bonuses, but the aim of the game is just keep going up and getting ship parts.
I mentioned it's a bit of avoidance, so as you get later in the game and you've identified a lot of the presents, which are your items in the game, you kind of start to prioritize, like, man, this is a big desert world. I'm going to get the hell out of here as quick as possible because they're awful. So you start to prioritize how to get through levels as time goes on because they get more and more dangerous. I can't believe how stressful a game of Funk can be at sometimes, but it can get stressful.
And also the worlds are really huge, so it's a test of patience.
Big,
yeah.
Do you think it's difficult to play, or do you think it's fairly natural?
I think it's fairly natural, but I'll say this now on the cast, I haven't beaten it single player yet.
You might find it a little bit easier single player, honestly. We did it over the PlayStation Network. We should mention it now. We've played it a few times over PlayStation Network since they released Toe Jam & Earl on that. And they actually give you like 8 lives when you do it over the internet like that. And I think it's just because there's a little bit of lag and latency when you do it that way. And I swear, when I play with you, there are so many ice cream trucks, like these phantom ice cream trucks that we'll talk about later. Unbelievable amounts. There's like 3 or 4 on one level we did recently. But when I play this local co-op on the Genesis in the same room, I saw like 2 or 3 of them total. Like, I think it was just a bit... I think it's a bit easier to do it local co-op than it is over the internet. I can't speak the mechanics there, but I think that's why they give you 8 lives each.
It could just be Matt that it knows the cold never bothered me anyway.
Not when I'm drinking water. Yeah. I think it's pretty natural. Navigating the present menu between drop and open at times can be a little bit wonky, but yeah. That's not so bad.
I feel like it's wonkier just because I've never played this on a Genesis. I've played it either through some other method or through the PSN, so I have more buttons than three, and it's really confusing which button is which.
Oh, that's true. The ABC buttons are laid out better for this game than the face buttons of the PlayStation controller, which plays fine.
Yeah, it plays fine. It's just awkward, considering the Genesis layout.
Genesis layout is so simple that that's what it's designed for.
Yeah.
Now, so backing up a little, do you consider this game a roguelike? We've kind of covered this before, but since it's pertinent to the podcast we've already done.
It's a fresh new cast.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it. Yeah, it definitely is a roguelike, all right? You got the randomized worlds, even though you can pick the fixed one, but, you know, it randomized makes it funkier. And the presents, which are your items, are also randomized, so it's got that going for it. And, I mean, there is permadeath, even though you get three lives, but, you know, once you lose three lives, that's it, back to square one.
Yeah. You can gain, like I said, you can gain lives as you promote and rank and all that as well. So there's, like, a level system to it. There's a... It's kind of like a roguelike if you remove the move on the same turn aspect, like the turn-based aspect. If you get rid of that, it sort of becomes a roguelike. And this is something I debate. When I first read that Toe Jam and Earl is considered a roguelike, I was like...
What?
Well, because in my experience, and this was like 7 or 8 years ago now, roguelikes were a very specific kind of game. A dungeon crawl that was turn-based in a very specific kind of way.
But right.
I've seen the light. Obviously, we talked about roguelikes and roguelites and all that on the roguelike podcast. So I've seen the light regard to that. And yeah, I can see it. And especially since they've said it's been inspired by Rogue and elements of roguelikes. Yeah, I can see it. So we mentioned that there's a fixed world and the random world for Toe Jam and Earl. The fixed world has 25 levels that are basically the same every time you do it, and the ship parts are on the same level every time. There's generally 25 floors to a level, or 25 worlds, and there's a secret zeroth world if you have the persistence to find it. That's a very cool world. We won't say much more about that because you should find it and surprise yourself. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. And grants you an advantage in the game. So.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. And pretty cool.
Yeah, and pretty interesting.
We could have just dragged this out.
Basically, that's how the level format of Toe Jam and Earl works. So, like, as you said, we complete a level and we go up a floor with the elevator. We don't necessarily have to go 25... floors. Like, I think we might have ended on floor 24 or something like that. It just depends on where the ship parts are found. How do you identify ship parts in this game?
When you first enter a level, you will actually get a message, so that's a relief. But you have to travel the whole world to find that huge flashing sign that says, "This is a ship part," and you're like, yes.
Yeah, so you find these gigantic signs, and they're pointing to a gigantic Cheeto, or Cheesy. And you get that Cheeto or Cheesy, and it turns out it's part of the Rapmaster Rocket, the totally bodacious ship of Toe Jam and Earl. Are the levels as simple as just walking across them, like, it is big empty spaces, or...
Level one will mislead you. You think, oh, it's just, you know, a little walking around and hit the elevator. Well, eventually, it ramps up. There are enemies, and they all have various ways of attacking you. Most of them seem to be doing their own thing, but a lot will actually seek out and injure you.
Yeah. What happens if you go off and, like, you're like, oh man, there's lots of water on this level? What happens if you walk off the edge on a level other than level one?
You will fall down the floor since you keep going up in the elevator. It's kind of like there's floating planes in space. I wouldn't know how to describe it, but that's the best way to explain it. So if you push yourself off the edge, you just land on the floor below you. So if you're on floor two and you walk off the edge, you get a little sound animation and a little wobble effect that you're on the edge and you're going to fall off. But, you know, if you keep pushing, then you'll fall down to floor one.
Yeah. I've actually frozen the Genesis by falling off a floor at the same time as someone else. It's actually seized the Genesis. So when we were going to find the secret world in our last playthrough, I was kind of concerned because we're both jumping down at the same time. And, yeah, the game started to hang a bit, but... like, it's not an ideally programmed game in that respect, I guess, because you're walking along and then all of a sudden, you know, the world starts to populate before your feet. And sometimes when a bridge is populated before your feet, like, it takes away some of the land under you and you fall anyways. Falling down is probably the most irritating thing in Toe Jam and Earl.
Especially because it lags. Yeah. And then, where do you end up?
Exactly, where do you end up? You keep your map, thankfully. So, it's not like the world gets shuffled again, so you keep your map. That's generally how you do it. We talked a little bit about it at the start, that you start to prioritize presents that you know are good. You start to prioritize, you know, either are you going to kill this enemy or are you going to just avoid it. Usually it's avoiding because you want to hold on to your presence as long as possible.
Yeah, you don't get many items that actually can attack anyway.
What would you say is a good general strategy to playing Toe Jam and Earl?
Keep your distance from a lot of things and walk along the edges.
Yeah.
But not too close. Just hopefully paths will open up if you walk along the edges most of the time. Also, I just find it easier to cover ground somehow, but that's just how it goes.
I find it that the enemies that pursue you often get hung up on edges, like the boogeymen and such will often get hung up on edges, especially if it's around water. If you've got the health to go into water and come out on another part of the coast.
And there's nothing in the water.
Yeah. Exactly. It's often best to jump in the water and come out somewhere else. So that's your general strategy for navigating the floor. But say you arrive on a new floor, basically what's your itinerary? Like, what do you do?
Assuming there isn't a ship part and I need to look for the elevator. Well, in either case, I would probably just pick a direction, hit an edge, and then try to walk along the perimeter because there is usually a ton of land to cover. And I slowly go through each square as I go around it and hopefully find something good. I mean, there's no point in exploring the entire map, but sometimes if that elevator is really hard to find, you end up doing it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And there's certain phones and such that you find that will reveal parts of the map. And you eventually find your way to it anyways. Maybe the most irritating part is you know that this elevator is going to be like in the northeast sector of the map, but you haven't found the bridge over there yet. And you can do some awesome trick jumps and such with various items you have, but I'm fairly sure it's not possible for the game to populate a world that you can't get to the exit with a land bridge because... presents are finite,
right.
So it can be kind of trying when you're looking for it to populate, and it's not. And it's especially trying if this is on a desert world, which we'll talk about a little bit. But yeah, I think the good general strategy, like you said, is if you know there's not a ship piece, then you know stick to the edges and try to find the elevator. I think a little bit of exploration's healthy. If you know that there's not a lot of enemies on the world, definitely try to get money and presents and things like that. Do you have a strategy or any advice for opening presents in this game?
Well, I'll talk about this a bit when we do the differences between single player and co-op, but I would make note and really remember what presents do what.
Yeah.
And hope you don't get the randomized one, because, oh boy, that is not a fun present to get. I hope you like having all your presents scrambled all over again.
Right.
They're all mysteries.
So, like, the presents are like scrolls or potions or books in other roguelikes. You can see them, and they look so delicious, but... looks delicious!
Yeah.
But, you know, you can see them, and they look great, and it's like, okay, I'll open this present. But the presents are randomized every time. Like, that little purple present might drop tomatoes on your head instead of giving you rocket skates this time. And I think it's relatively safe to identify a handful of presents when you start the game. Like, and if you get something like Icarus Wings or Super High Tops or Boombox or Decoy or something, so some of the top-tier presents, I think it's fair then to sort of hoard presents for a while, because if you get the randomizer, it'll fuck that all up. One thing you might want to do is note the position of the presents in your inventory, because even if you randomize them, the presents in your inventory don't change. They just change their appearance. So, like, if you're super high tops in a purple
box... Oh, man, I didn't realize that.
Well, it's under pressure. It's kind of tough to remember it. But, like, if you have super high tops in one box and it changes to another parcel, it's still super high tops. So, if you want to meta game it like this, it's possible. There is that carrot wise man that will identify presents for you for a couple of bucks.
$2,
right. And once you identify the randomizer, I'd say...
never pick up that present ever again.
Never pick up the present, and I think it's fairly safe to open identify presents again after that. There are presents that will instantly kill you, but there's also presents that will rank you up and presents that will give you extra life. So I don't think the Total Bummer present is as bad to open as the randomizer. That's just me.
Reward than risk. So. Yeah.
Once I know what the randomizer is, it's like, nope. Anything else after that, I'm well free to open if there's no wise man on the floor. Now, we're talking about presents, which are your main way of contending with Earthlings in this game. What presents do you feel are the best presents? And are there any that are a bit of a liability?
I definitely love the Icarus Rings. You just use them to flap around. You cover so much distance with them.
Yeah.
And they're not like rocket skates where you have, like, barely any control. But, yeah, Icarus Rings is probably one of the best presents you'll get in that game.
Yeah, they are definitely... Icarus Wings are top tier. For two-player, togetherness is really good because it will teleport you to your partner.
Yeah, solo gets Unfall, I think.
Yeah, yes, I think so. I think so. Other top-tier presents, Boombox is incredible. It just makes enemies dance and become harmless. And when you've got Phantom Ice Cream Trucks chasing you, that is so valuable. Super high tops are always good because moving fast in a game where you're basically walking... even Toe Jam, where it's fast, basically only walks unless you're running on a road. So super high tops are terrific because they let you go fast. And if you go to a gap, you will jump the gap.
Yeah.
If you're running. So they have a lot of utility.
I mean, even decoys on a road, it's still pretty slow, you know, to be quite honest.
Yeah. That's what might turn some people off the game, is how slow it can be.
Yeah.
But it's...
it's balanced with how enemies move, too. So yeah. You can't exactly speed yourself up, but then the enemies have to be sped up as well, which would be absolutely torture with ice cream trucks.
Yeah. And the obvious presence of, like, the extra life and the jackpot and things like that. Fudge Sunday. Yeah. Fudge Sunday is good, but root beer isn't that good because you start belching and waking people up.
Yeah.
Tomato rain will hurt enemies, but it'll also hurt you, and... yeah.
What a poor waste of those tomatoes. Oh, jeez.
There's some presents, like you said, like the Boombox and Icarus Wings that are undeniably the best, but I think some folks might find some items better than others. Like, some folks might like the rocket skates because of the speed that they give you to cross a great deal of land quickly. That's risky as hell, but I mean, you can do it.
Yeah, anytime I use the rocket skates, I'm always like holding my breath, hoping I don't accidentally roll myself off the edge or something.
Yeah, because if you went off the edge, you might fall like 5 fucking floors.
Yeah, because you're still going after you fall through the floor. You're like, oh no.
I don't know how much you've used the spring shoes, but they're also risky.
I use them a fair bit in my last playthrough. They do let you cover more ground, just don't be by the edges when you use them. I usually try to go more solid ground when I use them.
They're one of the only ways, I think, to kill Cupids, because if you go underneath them and jump, also if you use the unfall, I think you can kill Cupids with that, but that's a waste of it. But yeah,
I wasn't sure how to kill one. I always wondered that, because there was a Chivo about killing one. I was like, oh, how do I do that?
Yeah. You gotta get the Chivos.
Gotta get those Chivos.
You think the present system is a decent way, then? Because ToeJam and Earl themselves are kind of harmless on their own. Do you think the present system is good? Because if you lose your presence, then some areas become... you just can't deal with them.
I mean, it definitely is an interesting aspect. I mean, you need your items to get through the game, but it really bites when you lose a lot of presence and you're on floor 19 and everything's after you at the moment.
Yeah. I think it also sort of makes you think on your feet. Like, some people might discount rose bushes as being not that great, but I use rose bushes a lot because they stop enemies from chasing you. And you can just, like, oh, I've never used an inner tube, but now there's a big thing of water. I may as well use this inner tube.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I use a decoy a lot, so.
Yeah. Decoy use a lot because it's a lot more common than the boombox, but enemies will break decoys is the only problem with us.
I always just put the decoy and just run for it, so I never actually noticed they can break decoys.
As for using tomatoes and slingshots, basically some of the only offensive maneuvers that ToeJam and Earl have, and
they're awkward, like, to use.
Yeah, they're awkward to use. If you're getting chased by something, turning around and then, you know, the animation of the slingshot, it's not meant to be a running gun item.
You also have thrown an arc and it's awkward. Yeah.
At the very least, I think the boogeyman dies in two hits, so that's a saving grace there. But I say don't be afraid to open and identify presents and experiment with them, because you find a lot of presents in the game, and yeah, you might find you might find an auxiliary use for it that you didn't expect. We've talked a lot about presents. How do you feel about the earthlings in the game?
It's a really wild variety of earthlings and enemies. You have the wild ducks that are wasting all those precious tomatoes that I'll always complain about.
Yeah.
But they can chase you down. They're usually easily avoidable. There are bees, which are really, really annoying to avoid.
Yeah.
You get those shopping cart ladies, which are really mow you down. And the crowds of people. It's a really wild variety of things.
The man with the lawnmower is actually kind of terrifying because he can move pretty quick.
And the mailboxes are 90% of the time going to attack you.
Yeah. You can start sneaking up on them and they will, I think, you can see them open their eyes and close them. Like, the mailboxes, if you actually find a real one, can be really useful. But, yeah.
Good luck on finding one that's actually a real mailbox.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You like the Cupids and the hula dancers?
Cupids, I don't find as bad. I'm used to when games throws off the controls, I easily figure out which is what. But when hula dancers distract you and everything else is chasing you at the same time, it's really terrible.
You just can't stop the funk. It's like, you gotta dance.
Yep.
How about the boogeyman? We talked about the boogeyman a bit.
Boogeyman aren't as bad, but they are pretty irritating. They spawn really quickly, and they're really difficult to shrug off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not as bad as when I also encounter them with tornadoes, because tornadoes just show up and do whatever the hell they want. Usually they just dump me into empty space, so I fall down like 10 floors.
Yeah, tornadoes are the worst. Well, not the worst. Tornadoes are bad, and they usually appear on desert levels.
Which are already bad.
What would you say I would find the worst enemy? Probably the one I cursed out the most last time we played.
Ice cream trucks are still up there, so I want to say that one, but
That's not bad. It's an enemy that causes me to lose presence, though.
Oh, the fucking moles. God, fucking those moles.
Yeah, they're bad, and they've got this, like, you know, shit-eating face when they get you. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm so happy of what I've done to you. But, fucking moles. And they kind of, like, they don't go off on their own. They kind of get to where you are, and they kind of go back and forth like, you're not getting past me. And the person said they make you drop. You can't get them back. They're gone. Moles are bad. But you mentioned the Phantom ice cream trucks. Have a rundown of them, because we've talked about them a little bit on the podcast.
A bit already, yeah. I think the worst part about them is that they just seem to appear anywhere. It's like, oh man, they could appear on, like, grassy plains or on roads or on desert levels. And they're really bad on desert levels. It's just...
Yeah.
They're fast. You can't avoid them. It's just bad all around.
You hear a beeping and all of a sudden they appear in a puff of smoke and mow you down.
Yeah.
Because they're ghosts and they fly over things too. They're really fast. They do a lot of damage. And... for some reason, we had a floor where I was getting chased by like three or four of them at once. I was like, man, I've got to be out of this place. It's like, holy shit.
Man, what did the ice cream truck drivers have against aliens, right? Come on.
I think that's the level. I was like, you know what, fuck it. Please use your Icarus wings and we can get past this. Yeah. That was like really near the end. Yeah, so the enemies, do you feel that the enemies are imbalanced then? Or do you feel that they work with the game? Because... honestly, towards the end of it, they get really thick and really, like, dangerous, obviously. So, how do you feel about them overall?
For the most part, they're all right. I think the game balances them accordingly. And then, probably once you have, like, one ship piece left, that's when the game just starts to deck everything at you. And it's really frustrating. And the levels are, at that point, are gigantic. I think it's kind of a mess by endgame.
Yeah. But then again, that's what a roguelike does to you.
That's what roguelikes are.
You can't use that excuse for everything, I guess, but...
Yeah.
No, I think the way that the game plays out sort of requires you to learn the utility uses for the presence and know when to run the hell away and know to sort of grind it out the first half and then make spirit tracks the second half. Because once you get to, the last 10 floors, you're like, just get out quick as possible. Get out as quick as possible. And that's sort of the game of Toe Jam and Earl, really. Now, we've talked about how hairy this gets near the end. Does the potential to fall down the floors and get killed towards the end of Toe Jam and Earl make it more frustrating than fun near the end? Because it's pretty chill for the first half of the game, but as we said, it gets like Disney's bonkers towards the end of it. So, shit, can't believe I said that. So, the potential to like fall down and fail dramatically towards the end of Toe Jam and Earl make it more frustrating than fun.
Absolutely. First of all, there is the lag issue, which it's a long game to play because you move slowly and the worlds are huge. So by then you have to deal with the lag of falling down, which takes forever. It's like so unnecessary. And then to make your way back over also takes a really long time. It just, at that point, your patience has been, like, worn out, in my opinion.
Right. I can agree to some degree. I still find it a lot of fun, but then again, I've played it locally, and I've played it single player a lot. So, I've seen, like, all sides of Toe Jam and Earl by now. I've seen it at its worst, and I've seen it at its best. And I think that it is a roguelike in that sense, where if I lose Toe Jam and Earl, I don't feel that bad about it, because generally I play Toe Jam and Earl with a partner, and the whole process of playing with someone and the cooperation aspect of it, that kind of helps, you know, keep things a bit uplifting. It sort of does and doesn't, because if you're playing with someone, you're like, oh, I don't want to let this person down and we lose. But I find that the journey of Toe Jam and Earl is more to me than the ending of it. Even though the ending's cool, by the way, it means more to me. It definitely does get quite frustrating, though, if you fall four or five floors near the end of it. It does get frustrating. There's a way that if I fall four or five floors, I don't go all the way back up. I go the secret route, because if you go off the secret world, you go back to the top floor that you've reached. So I think that can help assuage that, but to go down the amount of floors you have to do that can be frustrating as well. I don't know what the hell is up with playing online with you, because I'm serious. I'm dead serious. The amount of shit that got thrown at us the couple of times I've played with you is out of control. I am serious about that. That might just be the true nature of Toe Jam and Earl. Maybe I've just gotten extremely lucky the other times I've played it. But I think you'll see a difference playing as solo. Number one, you'll rank up a lot faster solo. You'll rank up in the game by exploring and opening presents and getting ship parts and defeating enemies and things like that. You'll get to be a funk lord a lot sooner playing it solo, so you are a lot more capable. You'll have generally the whole screen to look at. You'll do it at your own pace and all that. I think you'll find the single player easier, especially if you use Toe Jam. It's definitely harder with a partner, but it's also a lot more fun. I think we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. I think I've made the comment a couple of times, how can a game about funk be so
stressful?
Yeah. And honestly, I was stressed out the last couple of floors the last time we played it. But again, I've had both experiences. I've had games of Toe Jam and Earl that's been chill the whole way, and I've had games that they get really stressful, and it's like, holy shit. But yeah, that's just my take. I am a bit of a fanboy of the game, but I know it gets frustrating towards the end.
To go back on the previous topic, I think it probably would be less frustrated if the lag for falling down floors wasn't so bad. I feel like maybe it might be more bearable for me, but for me, I don't know why that lag is so frustrating to me. I probably wouldn't mind trekking back to the elevators. It's just, you know, the whole whoa, and then you fall down and it takes 10 seconds and has to load the world again.
Well,
yeah.
It's frustrating, the lag at the end, because you know that, number one, the worlds at the end are fucking huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, number two, if there's a desert world you fall down to, you're going to fall
into desert, straight down in the middle of the desert.
Yeah. And there's going to be lots of tornadoes and moles to meet you.
Yeah.
The length of the game, I don't know, you say it's about a 2.5 hour game on average?
Is that how long we spent last time? I'm not sure.
Probably.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to talk about solo, which I'll say, I don't know, because I still need to beat solo, actually.
Right. We'll talk about that in a few moments, but
yeah.
I could see people getting frustrated at the end of the game that they've taken 2 hours to play it, and then all of a sudden the game is like, no, you're not going any further with this.
Yeah.
That's, again, guys, that's a roguelike. Unfortunately, there's no save feature in Toe Jam and Earl. If you're playing on the PSN,
I never expected one anyway. Oh, what? I wouldn't do it anyway.
Well, it's up to yourself. It's up to yourself. I wouldn't say scum it, but like I'd say if you play a half hour of the game and like, okay, it's getting stressful, or not even a half hour, like you play an hour,
take a
half
break,
the game.
Like take a break kind of thing.
Take a break. Please don't scum the game. But
that's what I mean. Don't save scum. That's not cool.
Yeah. I don't think you can save a multiplayer session anyhow. But I'd say the Genesis is easier to play the game. But if you want the quality of life upgrades that the PSN affords, or probably Steam and Xbox Live as well. Don't quote me on that, but it's probably on Steam because everything is. No, seriously. You can save and take a breather, because Toe Jam and Earl is meant to be a fairly chill game. It's meant to be fairly nonviolent and fairly about navigating an alien landscape, which is Earth in this case. If you're getting frustrated with it, I'd say take a break, because it does get frustrating, but it's not meant to be, I don't think. So you'll enjoy it a lot more with a clearer head and less ice cream truck horns.
But then you can hear them all over again. But yeah.
Now, we have talked about the game getting frustrating, and I mean, that's just a fact of the game. However, is the game in general, is it an ill game? Like, and I mean ill as in good, not as in effluvium.
Is it a rad game?
Yeah.
I think it's definitely a rad game. It definitely has charm being these two funky aliens on their roguelike journey to get their spaceship. That's unique enough in itself that I think makes it stand out. And it has a lot of its own flavor with just, like, the weird worlds and how it's set up. It just makes it a really cool game. And as much as I complained about it being frustrating about the end worlds, I mean, overall, it's a fun game, and I would recommend it.
Yeah. I agree. It's a good game. Obviously, I love the game, and I think anyone who's heard me talk about it over the last number of years, I really, really like Toe Jam and Earl. I supported the Kickstarter and all that, so I like Toe Jam and Earl. I like it a lot. I think it's one of the best games on the Genesis, full stop. It's unique. It's worth playing. Like, even if you get an hour out of it and you don't feel like the end game is for you, then that's still fine. I'd say maybe if you want a little bit of an advantage, play the fixed world and see where the ship parts are going to be, or you'll know the next time you play the fixed world, if you lose, that you know where things are already. So, I mean, there's options for the game, and there's even like a jam out session in it where you just see Toe Jam and Earl jam out to crazy backgrounds. So, I mean, it's got everything. So yeah, I really like the game, and we're talking about crazy backgrounds and things like that. Do you think the theme and like the funk and the flavor of the game is a product of its time, or do you think that kind of transcends history and is still kind of cool and relevant now?
I think it's definitely a product of its time, but since we're both kids of that era, it's pretty nostalgic, so it's still really hip for me.
Oh, I think you've got problems if you don't enjoy the beats of Toe Jam and Earl, but no, I don't. I've seen a lot of people, or maybe not a lot, but I've seen people say that the funk aspect of it is a product of its time, and they don't like that. I'm like, you know, was it going to be fucking dubstep in a world? It's like, there's a ton. I mean, sometimes dubstep's good in the game, but not everything needs to be updated for contemporary audiences. And I'm glad that the Toe Jam and Earl Back in the Groove Kickstarter seems to be harkening back to the first game. So, you know, not everything needs to be the same. There's room in the industry for funk. We talked briefly, I was mentioning that it seems a little bit easier on solo because you have a lot more control over your destiny there. Have you played any solo?
I have tried to play solo, yes. Not very successful. I will say right away, the biggest difference between solo and co-op is that it's just so lonely. Just wandering that world by yourself is just so depressing in a way.
You've maybe been spoiled by playing it.
Co-op, multiplayer, yeah. Which all my experiences previous were co-op, but I feel like that's the right way to play anyway. Oh, Toe Jam and Earl, right?
It's definitely the right way to play it. And I'm loath to say the right way to play something, but it's definitely the way that Toe Jam and Earl is intended to be played. I think it's one of the most cooperative games you can play because it doesn't matter who gets the last piece. It's a shared objective. And when you meet each other, you can slap skin and equalize your health, and the presents are a common pool, so you don't want your friend to open up a randomizer and screw everyone over. So, like, if you play a beat-em-up like TMNT 2 or something, there's a points counter when you defeat the foot, and like, okay, we're working together, but I want to get more points than you. With Toe Jam and Earl, it's like, you know, okay, you go this way, I'll go that way, and then we'll meet back here. It's a very cooperative game, and like, even Toe Jam being able to move in and get something while Earl distracts him with his, you know, extra health and things like that, everything about it is sort of geared towards cooperative play. And like I said, it's not co-opetition, it's purely cooperative. I think that's actually more rare than co-opetition. Anyway, that's my take on that.
Yeah, especially because it's co-op working together. That aspect really blends in because of the shared presence and all that. because I played solo and I have to identify everything, I'm definitely a lot more gung-ho with opening things.
Yeah.
So my last playthrough, I got hit with a randomizer twice, and that really bites.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I played it similar to how I would play other roguelikes, where if I had, like, a mystery scroll, if there's an enemy around me, I'd probably say, alright, time to use this item and see whatever the heck it does, and got some bad deals on that, so...
But, like, Crawl doesn't have a scroll that makes you forget every other scroll you've read, so...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, a fucking randomizer.
Yeah, it's definitely easier to promote, and I guess you don't really need to worry as much as letting the other person down in solo mode. But yeah, it just for me, I didn't like the experience because it was so empty, and I played you a lot more gung-ho, as I said. I screwed myself by just opening things on the whim. Probably need more strategy on that aspect, but solo mode. I gotta get the Shivo somehow. I'll get some local co-op then.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah, if you can find someone that'll sit down and play Toe Jam and Earl with you, I definitely recommend that you do that, because, I mean, I think it's very apt that you said it's a lonely experience, and I think where your first foray into Toe Jam and Earl was co-op, then that does definitely impact how you feel about the solo mode, because I don't know, it is sort of a really close experience when you play Toe Jam and Earl with someone, you know. Yeah, I mean, I can see, especially where Toe Jam and Earl was does have a lot of history with us as well, that started the Broforce stuff and all that, so there's history there, and you're attaching that to playing it cooperatively as well. So it's about being bros and being cooperative and friendship, and how that overcomes the xenophobia of Earth. So I think the cooperative aspect of the game is extremely important to how you experience Toe Jam and Earl. So anyone that's listening to this and feels like playing the game, like, find someone on, like, PSN or Steam or whatever to play it with, or get a buddy over to play it with. You know, maybe take some convincing to get someone to play a 25-year-old game with you, but I think it'd be worthwhile. So, yeah.
I don't know, a 25-year-old game would be the same, but I'd say a 2.5-hour-long game would be the thing you need to convince someone to get over.
Well, I don't think you need necessarily play through to the end with someone. I mean, that's great, and I've done that a few times, but I've also played the game not to the end. I think, like I said, with Toe Jam and Earl, it's the voyage, and I think that speaks volumes considering you didn't get the ending. The Toe Jam and Earl
I can't believe you don't get the ending or Chivos when you do online PSN. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's a bit bullshit that you don't get the ending, because they could have done it. Anyhow, that's beside the point.
You know, the funny part is I still don't know what the ending looks like. I've kept it a secret to myself, so I have to earn it.
Are you doing the fixed world or random worlds?
Random world, of course, man. Random Come on, worlds, that's a cool way to go. Exactly,
yeah, I think you'll like it when you get it. You'll probably agree that it's better when there's two people in it, but yeah.
Earl's on vacation. Like, oh, man, come on. Earl, my buddy, come back.
Earl is a doofus.
Earl can't be a funk lord with me. I mean, oh, come on.
Do you have any final thoughts on Toe Jam and Earl?
I think it's a really funky game. As stressful as it is, it's still pretty rad and definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I think I've made it really apparent over the last bit of podcast that I really like this game. And I can't sing its praises enough. I would say playing Toe Jam and Earl, not necessarily even to completion, but playing Toe Jam and Earl with someone, and you like these kind of games, these roguelike games, or you dislike having friends, you know, yeah, you can, it's worth giving it a shot at least once in your gaming career. So, yeah. I'd say just give it a shot. Not for everyone, of course. None of the games I like are. But Toe Jam and Earl is funky, fresh, and Yeah, I like it.
I mean, you definitely love it way more than I do, but I'm definitely in the good standings with it. It's a good game, and thumbs up.
So, thank you for listening to our Toe Jam and Earl podcast. I realized the actual material of Toe Jam and Earl was maybe a little shorter than the intro, and I'm sorry about that, but...
I think that was just the nature of how things worked out, considering the gap between recordings and how short this game is, in theory, to talk about.
Toe Jam and Earl's kind of a play-don't-tell game, to be honest, but I'm glad we could share about it with you guys. Where can we reach you on the internet, Chris?
You can reach me at twitter.com/Karasu, CAWRASU. I do have a link to my blog there. I don't know if I really want to advertise it, but I'm just going to say that I have a blog there, and I'm just using it to do some translation practice, because apparently Fire Emblem has really inspired me to do this a lot.
Okay, well, there you have it. Where can we reach our horse, Arrow?
You can reach our horse at twitter.com/agrocast, AGROCAST.
And where can we reach you, Matthew? Well, you can reach me at twitter.com/metazoic, MATTOZOYC. It's like the Mesozoic era, except the dinosaurs are better. Website's the same, metazoic.com. What are we going to be doing in the merry, merry month of May?
In the merry, merry month of May, we're bringing this back from last year, I guess, but we're going to play some classic Mega Man games, which is a fun story that I'll admit now. I have never beaten a classic Mega Man game, so this should be a whole new adventure for me. I'll be like, why can't I charge my Buster? Why can't I wall jump? Why can't I... What happened to X? Where's Zero?
On fanfiction.net.
Yeah.
But anyhow, folks, we'll decide the format of this, but we're going to do some classic Mega Man games, so you can look forward to that for the next podcast. Again, thanks for listening, and we will see you in a month's time. Cheers.
Dark Metamorphosis!